I think it's time for us to start our class this evening. Thank you for being here as we continue on in our study in the book of Judges. Our plan for this evening is to finish chapter 2. We had discussed the first 5 verses last week and then talk about all of chapter 3. So we've got a lot of ground to cover and we're going to jump right in. Just as a quick review, last week we discussed mainly the first chapter, which described the conquests of the Israelites starting at the south, moving towards the north, and moving from successes to failures in the north. And that led to the beginning of chapter 2 when the angel of the Lord appeared to the Israelites and pronounced judgment against them for their failure to completely conquer the land as God had promised. Moving on now into the rest of chapter 2, we had just briefly talked about those initial battles, the seeds of apostasy, and then the angel of the Lord and Israel's apostasy thereafter. This evening, we're still in part 1, which are the first 2 chapters, the introductory chapters to Judges, and we're going to start with verses 6 through 10, which take us back a little bit in time, as we talked about in the previous 2 classes. Joshua's death is now being discussed in verse 8 of chapter 2, but before that, he dismissed the people, which was also recorded back in Joshua 24 and verse 28. So Joshua sends the people away, every man into his inheritance, and then further details of Joshua's death and burial are given in verses 8 and 9 of Judges chapter 2. And these have also been recorded at the end of Joshua. If Caleb, who remember was a contemporary of Joshua, was about 85 years old, we read about Caleb last week in the first chapter. He led some of the endeavors in the land of Canaan to conquer them. If he was about 85 years old when these events took place, the conquest of the land of Canaan, then there would have been individuals 65 and under, who would still have been considered, I think, contemporaries of Joshua and Caleb and also elders. And that's part of the generation that's discussed in verse 10. All that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and then tragically there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done in Israel. This is the generation that's mentioned here in verse 10, which is those who succeeded came after Joshua, Caleb, and then the contemporaries of them who had led a strong initial conquest of the land of Canaan, but then subsequently other generations failed to conquer the land wholly as God had promised and commanded. In verse 8, the great work that the Lord had done for Israel included things like parting the Jordan River so that the entire nation of Israel could walk across, and that occurred during the flood stage, which would have looked something like this. We'll talk more about the Jordan River a little bit later in class tonight. It would have also included the giving of the law. You remember how much of a production that was with all of Israel gathered at the base of Mount Sinai, everything that was going on the mountain, Moses receiving the law there, his provision, God's provision for them during the wilderness wandering for those 40 years, and the initial successful takeover of Canaan. Those are all the things that many of the Israelites who have now passed away witnessed firsthand. He's referring back to this generation of Israelites who had witnessed these initial stages of the conquest of Canaan. There is, interestingly, also the conquering of Jericho. Remember, that was the first city that they conquered in Canaan. There is this thing called the Merneptah steel. That's how you say it. It dates to around 1200 BC, and on it, who can interpret this? Apparently this means Israel. So I'm not real good with dates, and I'm not real good with places or names either. But this being about 1200 BC, they think that Israel left Egypt around 1400 BC. And then the monarchy arose in Israel about 1000 BC. So those 400 years between when they left Egypt and then finally the year 1000 when Saul became king, within that time period, the Egyptians were aware of Israel in the land of Canaan. And for a while, this was the earliest known record of Israel in the land of Canaan until later, where this was discovered, a Berlin statue pedestal relief, and that also means Israel. And this dates to about 1400 BC. So about the time that Israel was being delivered out of Egypt before their wilderness wandering, they're being talked about and recorded in these Egyptian records, which I think is really fascinating and should be a good faith builder for us, that all we're reading about corresponds to what's being found, incidentally, in these historical records. Let's go back to this other generation that arose after them. This is where, as we talked about in our introductory class, the breakdown occurred, where the faithlessness began, this breakdown in leadership on the level of the nation, yes, but probably more significantly, the level of the home, where the Israelites had been charged to teach their children about all these things that they had witnessed that God had done for them, to instill in their children the law and what it should mean for them. And that's what's referring to here when it says they did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for them, where they didn't have that close covenantal relationship that they should have had. But is firsthand witness of events, as we previously talked about, required for a faithful relationship to God? Did these subsequent generations have to see all these things firsthand in order to be pleasing to God? Wyatt? That's right. And for us, it's also not required. And that reminds me of John 20 and verse 29, where Jesus, in speaking to Thomas, said, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." So that could have been true for this subsequent generation that arose after Joshua and Caleb and their contemporaries. And that should be true about us today. We don't see, we haven't seen firsthand the events of the New Testament or the Bible, but we can read about them and we can be blessed in our belief and our faith based on what we read and what we come to believe and the traction that it takes in our lives and the changes that it promotes within us. Moving on now, we're going to close out chapter 2. And we discuss this at length in our introductory class, which is the cycle of faithlessness, crying out to God, him raising up a judge, delivering the affected Israelites in that area of Israel or Canaan during that time, and then them, reverting to their sinful ways. One of the things that God had expressly forbidden was any kind of knowledge or participation in the idolatrous activities of the people of the land of Canaan. Turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 12. We're just going to read the last few verses here in Deuteronomy 12. In Deuteronomy 12, starting in verse 29, it says, "When the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations whom you go in to dispossess, and you dispossess them and dwell in their land, take care that you not be ensnared to follow them after they have been destroyed before you, and that you do not inquire about their gods, saying, 'How did these nations serve their gods? That I also may do the same.' You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way, for every abominable thing that the Lord hates, they have done for their gods, for they even burn their sons and their daughters in the fire to their gods. Everything that I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add to it or take from it." So, flash forward a couple of hundred years, maybe just 100 years. What sets off this cycle is Israel's disobedience to those very commands. That's what is talked about here. They're worshiping the Baals and the Ashtaroth, these gods of the peoples of Canaan, false gods. This is a Canaanite temple that has been excavated in the land of Canaan, and these are some of the artifacts that have been found at that site, figurines of some of these false gods that they would have been tempted to worship, along with some of these pottery items. This is an image of Baal. So Baal figures prominently in the Old Testament as a real challenge for the Israelites. They were pressured to serve Baal, and they served Baal. And Baal was the storm god, essential then for fertility in the land. The other god that's mentioned here is Ashtaroth, who is a goddess of war, thus key for success in battle. So you can imagine the Israelites, with their history of idolatry in Egypt and coming out of Egypt, inhabiting the land of Canaan, failing to completely conquer the land and having these bad influences around them, that they were induced to, pressured to worship these false gods. This is pictures of Ashtaroth. And by the way, if it's not confusing enough, Ashtoreth, is the same as Astarte, which is the same as Ishtar. There's also a plural form of it. And then in chapter 3, we're going to read about Asheroth, which is not the same as Ashtaroth. If I had seen this slide in school, I would have put a star by it knowing like there are going to be questions on the test about this. But thankfully, there's no test. You don't have to really remember this. Just lump them all together and know that these are the false gods that the Israelites were tempted to worship and that they did regrettably end up worshiping. And again, we've already read from Deuteronomy 12. Last week, we read from Psalm 106. God said that the things that the Canaanites did in worship to these gods were abhorrent to him, were an abomination, including, as we've said, sacrificing their own children. So this isn't just making figurines and putting one up in your house, although that would be sinful as it is. It involved much more than that. So what was God's response to the Israelites? They rejected God. He reacts with righteous anger, hands them over to be oppressed by their enemies. In that oppression, they repent and cry out to God. He raises up a judge to rescue them, and then they relapse back into that same cycle. And we're going to read about two or three of those cycles in chapter 3 just this evening. So God's response to their unfaithfulness was anger. In fact, the NET says in verse 14 of Judges 2, the Lord was furious with Israel and handed them over to robbers who plundered them. So God hands them over to these plunderers or raiders or marauders. And the text actually says in verse 15 that God's hand was against the Israelites. And what a sad turn of events that is, where all that he had done to rescue them from their bondage and all that he had done for them, now, based on their decisions, he is now against them. And it says they were in terrible distress. Any questions or comments before I move on to the last few verses of chapter 2? Moving on then to verse 16. It continues with the description of the cycle of the nation of Israel over the next several centuries. So just big picture view, this is the cycle that's going to repeat itself again and again. But as I pointed out and want us to continually remember is that it's not just that the cycle was repeating itself, but that it was getting worse and worse. When they relapsed into evil, they were more corrupt than their fathers before them. So more accurately, again, this can be described as a downward spiral into faithlessness in the book of Judges. Notice in verse 17, the Israelites' response to their judges. It says they did not listen to their judges. And the ESV says they whored after other gods and bowed down to them. And that metaphor of Israel's committing adultery against God, of course, is one of the most powerful in the Old Testament. And in fact, in the book of Judges, there's going to be several instances of prostitution that we read about later in the narrative. And those just seek to highlight, to throw into sharp relief, this act of adultery that Israel is committing against God, their deliverer, and their one true Lord, who should have been their one true Lord. How, though, did God react to their distress? How does it say in verses 15 and 18 that God reacted? Did he say, you know what, that's it. I'm done with y'all. It's up to you. What does it say he did for them? Teresa?
Pity.
He was moved to pity.
He saved them.
Yes. He was moved to pity by their groaning. He saved them. He delivered them. Here the NET translates it, the Lord felt sorry for them when they cried out in agony because of what their harsh oppressors did for them. So he would raise up this judge, as we're going to read about, Othniel, and then Ehud, and then Shamgar in chapter 3. He would raise up these judges who would deliver them from their oppressors, and then the Israelites would have peace. But that peace wouldn't last, and they again would revert to their old ways. I want to say, just before I move on to chapter 3, again, how tragic it is that this land, which had been promised to Abraham's descendants, has again become soiled by its inhabitants' behavior. God purged, meant to purge the land of Canaan from evil people who were living there, taking part in all of these abominable and idolatrous activities. And his intention was for his covenant people to live there, to be holy, to thrive. And now they've become just as bad as the people that they're meant to dispossess. And he had warned them, if you do that, the land's going to vomit you out as well in Leviticus. That brings us to the end of chapter 2. To finish out this part one, we have six verses at the beginning of chapter three that I want to consider, but I'll stop there, or stop here for any questions or comments before we go on. Yes, sir.
It says, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had spoken and as the Lord had sworn to them. We often talk about God's faithfulness and his love, but he is also faithful in his judgment.
Yes.
And he told them what he's going to do, and he did what he said he was going to do.
Yes, good point.
And should be a sobering thought for us, because he's done the same for us. He's promised us rich blessings in our life if we'll follow him, obey him, worship him, serve him wholeheartedly, but consequences if we refuse to do that. And just as he's proving here, he is good to his word, we should be confident he'll do the same today. Anything else? All right, so the beginning of chapter 3 casts a little bit different spin, not different, but an additional view for us to understand why these nations were left in Israel. And that, according to the first six verses of chapter 3, was to test them in the sense that they would have the opportunity to experience warfare and to hone their warrior skills, for lack of a better way to put it. So the nations that remain to test Israel provide for them an opportunity for battle experience. And that should be understood in the context of what we just talked about at the end of chapter 2, was that God had originally intended for all these peoples to be dispossessed, that at some point God through Joshua, allowed some to remain as a test, and those nations that were meant to remain as a test and for them to continue to hone their skills in battle turned out to be actually left for punishment, as again, a thorn in their side. So the word here that's translated as test can also convey the idea of training by experience. So did they follow God's command and purge the land of these evil people? Sadly, no. In verses 5 and 6, we get our answer. The Israelites lived among the people of Canaan. They intermarried with them, which again was against God's will, and they served their gods. So he had left them so that he could test the willingness of later generations to learn and engage in war tactics, and that would measure their allegiance to the Lord. So those are the comments I have to make on those first six verses before we finish up part one of Judges and move on into part two, which encompasses chapters 3 through 16. But I'll pause here again for any questions or comments. Yes, sir.
Give us a little bit of clue into how God thinks about us living here. You know, one of the problems that is talked about so much nowadays is the problem of suffering. Why does God allow suffering? Why does he allow illness and distress and wars and all of this sort of thing? And we see even then that even though he was trying to bless them, he was trying to make them into something better. He was trying to improve their skills, and while also using them to remove these other people that gone against what he wanted them to do. But he wanted those people to be better. And so he put something in their way that would force them to either get better or suffer the consequences.
Yes, very good point.
And the judges we're going to read about tonight actually provide a bright spot in that history, because they did step up and take charge and lead Israelites in against these oppressors of theirs. But overall, throughout this period of about 300 years, that was not the case overall. Thanks. Anything else? Yes, sir.
The promise was if you don't straighten up in time, this cycle, you know, just isn't going to continue. And then, of course, Jerusalem, you know, got destroyed eventually. And we were just reading about Daniel. And right after the 7 years of captivity, he prayed to God and said, we have sinned. As it is written in the law of Moses, all this disaster came upon us. And because, you know, we've sinned. And so the 70 years are over now, and they're rebuilding the temple. But he's praying to God, say, yeah, this all happened. And best we can tell, it did away with idolatry. 70 years. So eventually figured it out. This is good. Hard.
All righty. Let's jump into our first judge, Othniel. Have we talked about Othniel before? Yes. Last week we talked about Othniel. So he was the one who conquered this city back in chapter 1 at Caleb's urging his future father-in-law, and I'll see if I can get it right this week. So Othniel was either Caleb's younger brother or his nephew. We don't know for sure. But he ends up marrying Caleb's daughter. And he is the first judge we read about here. And encapsulated in these few verses is the very cycle that we just talked about. So people of the Lord did Israel. People of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. God was angry, and he raised up this oppressor, a man, king, called Cushan-Rishathaim, which could be translated Cushan the doubly wicked, and they were his subjects for 8 years. Under that oppression, they cry out in verse 9. The Lord raises up Othniel in verse 9 as a deliverer for them. He saved them from this oppressor, and they had rest for 40 years. What happens, though, after Othniel, the judge, dies? Well, we read in verse 12, the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So again, they're worshiping and serving the Baals and the Asheroth. Again, Asheroth is not the same, apparently, as Ashtaroth from verse 2, from chapter 2 and verse 13, but was, again, one of the false gods, one of the idols endemic to this area, and God had specifically commanded them back in Exodus 34, 13, to tear down their altars, break their pillars, and cut down their Asherim, which is the false god that's mentioned here in these verses about Othniel. So here we have Caleb's younger brother or his nephew who had married his daughter. It's also said that the Spirit of the Lord was upon him and that he judged Israel. As we talked about in our introductory class, being a judge in the book of Judges normally involved these military endeavors, but also carried with it a judicial function where people, Israelites with complaints or issues, would come to the judge and they would help solve those problems for them. And those two words are used to describe Othniel here. He was a Judahite, so from the tribe of Judah, but actually was a Kenizzite, which was a foreign clan that had been grafted into the tribe of Judah. And during his tenure, after he had delivered them from the king of Mesopotamia, the Israelites had rest for 40 years. So Othniel stands as our first judge and an example, a good example, of doing what God needed him to do during this time, which is to rescue the Israelites back and also to oversee a period of peace, in this case for 40 years, for the Israelites. We'll move on to the next judge, the real exciting story of Ehud here in a second. But does anybody have any comments or questions on Othniel?
We may have talked about this last week, and if we did, I apologize. That it says that Othniel is the son of Kenaz, who is Moses' father-in-law. If we remember, that he's from Edom. Like, that's an Edomite. And I think that's telling when we talk about the difference between, or God talking about the difference between Israel and Edom. Those are all, they're always pitted against each other. Edom being the evil ones, and Israel supposed to be the holy ones. And so I think it's really interesting that here at the beginning, the deliverer of Israel is not even Israelite. He's actually a bad foreigner, like not just a foreigner, but a bad foreigner in like the grand scheme of the Old Testament. I just think that's interesting.
Othniel, you said that somewhere it said that he was an Edomite.
Chapter 1, verse 13, Othniel, the son of Kenaz.
Kenaz, okay. Yes, and then you're saying Kenaz is related to Edom?
Kenaz is Moses' father-in-law.
There's, I'm going to get this straight, we're going to talk about it in 2 weeks. Jethro, who's also called Hobab, who's also called Reuel, if that's how you say his name. That's Moses' father-in-law. But I can double-check if he also has a fourth name. It wouldn't shock me at this point because I've been trying to nail down that exact relationship. But for sure, the Kenizzites, as far as I'm able to tell, were at one point a foreign clan that had been grafted in. And even when we talk about Shamgar being the son of Anath at the end of the chapter, it's not thought that Anath was an Israelite per se. He may have been a foreigner. It's not known for sure. But you're right that these are not necessarily what we would call pure-blooded Israelites leading the charge. but serve as, you know, great examples of deliverers. But I'll look more into that. Yeah, thanks. And then Mark, you had your hand up.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that very first 8, it says that the people of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim for 8 years. And it doesn't specify there whether it took the Israelites 8 years to realize they were in a bad position or they had realized it, but God didn't do anything about it. So you get different things from that depending on what the situation is there. But when they did cry out, God was responsive to that. Now, it might have been that it took a few years, maybe God allowed them to be punished for a few years before he brought a deliverer to them. To get the lesson through to them.
Yeah. And we're going to see that too with Ethan.
Because they served Eglon 18 years. As we'll kind of see, part of that service was bringing him tribute. And so that was still expected of the Israelites. And it was at that opportunity that Ehud took Eglon's life. That's okay.
Judges 1:16. And the descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up to the people of Judah.
Yeah.
So descendant, not direct.
Yeah.
My bad.
So the Kenites and then the Kenizzites,
which may be the same, may not be. But either way, you're right, that their Caleb and Othniel were grafted in at some point being Kenizzites, it's thought. And so, you know, he stands as a great example here as our first judge. All right, let's move on now to talk about Ehud. So Moab is the oppressor now. I don't have the map up here, but imagine the land of Canaan here, the Dead Sea down here, Moab is down in this area. Can you visualize it? Okay. We'll get to a slide in just a second where hopefully that's a little clearer. But Moab, their leader here, Eglon, oppresses Israel. He joins forces with the Ammonites and Amalekites to defeat Israel and take possession of the City of Palms. What city is that referring to, City of Palms? Wyatt?
Jericho.
Yeah, exactly right, Jericho. So Jericho was, again, Israel's first success in conquering, first major success in conquering west of the Jordan River, and now it's fallen back into enemy hands. So how demoralizing, defeating, and discouraging that must have been for the Israelites. The Amalekites, interestingly, are related to Edomites in the Old Testament. Amalek was the grandson of Esau, who was the father of the Edomites. So they're banding together with the Ammonites, Moabites, to take back the City of Palms, Jericho. And as one writer noted, this is a good example at this time for the Israelites to realize that salvation for past generations does not secure salvation for the present. So they still needed to keep up their faithfulness to God. They didn't, and so he allowed Jericho to be taken back into enemy hands. And as we mentioned previously, they were his subjects for 18 years. So this may be a little bit more helpful. So here's the Jordan River, and here are some fords or crossings to the Jordan River. So remember, there were no bridges back in these days. So in order to cross from one side to the other, you'd have to find a low place in the river and cross over there. And the Moabites had taken control of the fords, had taken control of Jericho as well. And that's where apparently Eglon had set up his base. So Ehud is the next judge introduced now, and we learn a couple of things about him. First of all, we learn he's from the tribe of Benjamin. The name Benjamin means son of the right hand, and Ehud is what? Left-handed. In the Hebrew, it actually says literally restricted in the right hand, which may have meant that he had been trained as a warrior have an advantage using his left hand, or that he may have been handicapped in his right hand. So here, author of Judges is introducing Ehud, a Benjamite, son of the right hand, restricted in the left hand, and he's going to come up against Eglon. Does anybody know what the name Eglon means? It means little calf. So why is that ironic? Little calf? He wasn't little, yeah. He wasn't little, so he's described as a large man. And so here we have left-handed Ehud, a Benjamite, up against little calf described as very fat, according to the ESV. So Ehud is responsible for taking, along with this cohort, tribute to King Eglon here in Jericho. And as such, it's easy to see then that Ehud would have been familiar with the layout of, I'm really trying not to get them confused. If I do, I'm sorry. Eglon's living quarters. He fashions a two-edged sword, probably more like a dagger. He hides it in his right thigh. And after bringing his tribute to Eglon, it actually says, if you read it carefully, that Ehud turns back at the idols in Gilgal and then goes back to Jericho, where Eglon was, and tells Eglon, I have a secret message for you, O king. That's in verse 19. And Eglon sends away his attendants, and on that, Ehud takes the opportunity to take that dagger in his right thigh and thrust Eglon through and kill him. And then, as if the story wasn't interesting enough, we now have the perspective of Eglon's servants. They're waiting on their master, who they believe to be using the restroom, and they wait so long that they're embarrassed before they finally use a key and unlock the door and go in and find him dead there on the floor. In the meantime, though, Ehud had escaped. Ehud had gone, okay, this is a rendition of what it may have looked like, so an audience chamber where Eglon may have seen folks, and then this upper room where he may have had the opportunity to relieve himself. And that was in Jericho. And Ehud, while Eglon's there dead on the floor, door locked and his servants waiting outside, embarrassed to encroach on their master, he escapes to Ephraim and calls up a force. And so not only is Eglon defeated on this occasion, king of Moab, but Ehud calls up these warriors from Ephraim, and the NET translates verse 28 in this way, where Ehud says to them, follow me, for the Lord is about to defeat your enemies, the Moabites. They followed him, captured the fords of the Jordan River opposite Moab, and did not let anyone cross. And so those fords in the Jordan River are reclaimed by the Israelites from Ephraim, who helped Ehud in his battle. So they reclaim these important crossing points here on the Jordan River. And just to highlight again another instance of what we're seeing in verse 28, where Ehud speaks of the Lord's or God's defeat of the Moabites as a done deal. He says, follow me, for the Lord is about to defeat your enemies, the Moabites. He spoke of it faithfully, confidently, that God was able to deliver on his promise, which was to rescue them from this oppressor. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and on this occasion, according to verse 30, they have rest for 80 years. So really interesting story, very graphic in the sense of the details that are described here, and you can really picture the scene as it's developing here. But again, this is all part of God's will to do the work that should have been done, and that's to say, eradicate these Canaanites from the promised land that the Israelites were meant to inhabit. So that's all I have to say about Ehud. What comments or questions do y'all have about him? All right. I don't have 6 minutes worth of things to say about Shamgar, so I'll just talk really slowly. All right. Yes, go ahead.
That it seems like the judges that are raised up are, it's because that everyone else is waiting for somebody else to do something. You see that with Gideon a little bit later. You have Othniel, who was given the land of the Negev, which is totally opposite of Mesopotamia. So, you know, the entire nation of Israel, it took somebody who was on the very opposite side to do anything. You have Ehud, who's presenting something to the king, and then turns back, and then, you know, goes back again. It's like someone's waiting for somebody to do something, and that's, I think, a lesson for us to recognize that we have to have the attitude of "Here I am, send me." And those judges seem like those are the kind of guys who God raised up, as the ones who were willing and ones who wanted to be the one to do something.
Yes, good point. And we'll see that in next week's class with Deborah and Barak, where he was hesitant and needed motivation from her to do what he needed to do. So that's very clearly a case where he knew what he needed to do and he needed motivation to step up. And so maybe getting ahead of myself, but my encouragement for next week's class, which I'll go ahead and say now, is that we should be that person for someone else. We should be Deborah for other people. If you see someone in your life who you know needs encouragement or motivation, be that encouragement or motivation for them to help them step up to the task and get the work done that needs to be done. But y'all can forget that in 7 days, and I'll repeat it next week, and you can think it's really great. So Shamgar has one verse written about him. We're told he's the son of Anath, which again is thought not to be a native Israelite, but I don't know for sure. I don't have a way to prove that. Said that he's killed 600 of the Philistines with an ox goad, and he also saved Israel. The only other time we're going to read about Shamgar is in Deborah and Barak's song in chapter 5. And besides those two mentions, as far as I know, that's the only time that we read about him. But he stands with Ehud and Othniel as positive examples of courageously working for God's cause, as Daniel put it well, of stepping up and getting the work done that needed to be done, getting their hands dirty, and doing the Lord's work. So this is an ox goad. So maybe not an ideal tool for killing others, but Shamgar apparently was effective at it. Regrettably, though, the good reputation and work of these earlier judges that stand out in chapter 3 is going to slowly deteriorate through the narrative as we go. And really, Gideon serves as kind of the inflection point in Judges, where we go from upstanding judges who did what needed to be done and were good examples to, toward the end of his life and then after him, not great examples, who had lots of judges who had lots of problems, thorny issues. So for this week, our takeaway is to be thankful. To observe this pattern that we talked about back in chapter 2 and that repeated itself over and over again in chapter 3 that demonstrates God's steadfast love, that he didn't just stand by and let the Israelites suffer in their oppression, that he provided for them these opportunities to grow and to be tested, but also with deliverers. He listened to their cries of his oppressed peoples. He arranged for their deliverance. That's the same God that we serve today. That when we recognize the deliverance that we need, and we cry out to him in sincere repentance, we have a deliverer, and that's Jesus, the Messiah. And by following him and submitting to him, we are saved from the bondage of sin. In Romans chapter 5 and verse 6, it says, "For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows his love for us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." So let's be thankful that we serve the same God from Judges who took care of his people then and takes care of people today with their greatest need. All right, so looking ahead to next week, we're going to plan to discuss chapters 4 and 5, which is Deborah and Barak's story, which is also a really gripping tale. And with that, that's all I have to say. And we have about a minute left if someone has a concluding comment or question. Yes, sir.
You know, it's interesting when you look back historically through the Old Testament how zealous the Lord was to try and keep Israel untainted by the countries around them, by these nations, right? Yet we read here about these people who are part of the body of Israel who were grafted in. You know, Jethro's descendants being a prime example, and there are others as well. And it brought to mind the very end, the last couple verses of Romans chapter 2. When Paul writes that the person who's a Jew is not one outwardly just because of circumcision in the flesh, but the one whose heart is right before God. And I find that very encouraging because there is no regard from God to our outward appearance, our heritage, our genetics, any of those things. But simply, if we have the right heart before him and will take the right actions. And that's pretty amazing that in all this and all the effort to keep this country untainted, pure, if you will, he never turned away that sincere person. And they played a major role.
Absolutely. I mean, think about the very next book.
Ruth, where what an integral role she played in the lineage even of King David and then Jesus. Janet, you had a comment?
There's for you.
Well, I just am shocked every time I hear, going back to the beginning of this class, about it took one generation for them to forget God. But you also see that they intermarried with those who did not know God. And if you marry, I know an instance right now of a man that's married to a woman from a foreign country, and she is teaching her child to speak the language of the foreign country where she's from, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. But in this case, these children were not being taught about God and who has the most influence over a child the first few years of their life. It's their mother. And so they were learning the language of Baal.
Thank you very much.